This is Virginia Insight. I'm Tom Graham. Ben Converse is fascinated by how you think and how that compares to how you think you think and why you think you do certain things when in fact you did them for a completely different reason than what you thought. In other words, Ben is a social psychologist. In a series of recent investigations, he's been uncovering remarkable insights into human motivation. His latest, showing how most of us go about trying to create good karma for ourselves without even knowing we're doing it, even if we don't believe in karma in the first place. So although you may not have a superstitious bone in your body, this could still be your lucky day when you get to hear all about Dr. Converse's findings on what compels us to be as we are. It's all coming up, if the fates are with us, right after the news. I'm Tom Graham, and this is Virginia Insight. Ever notice other people behaving strangely? Ever notice yourself behaving in ways that are hard to explain even to yourself? We've got a social psychologist with us this hour who might be able to offer some insight if you'd be willing to share those experiences with us. Or if you've just got a question about why people act the way they do, especially when they do not seem to know that they are doing it. The easy way to remember our phone number, 888-WMRA-TALK, but in all numbers, that's 888-967-2825. Dr. Benjamin Converse, thanks so much for making time for us.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Well, Dr. Converse's latest research publication is in the journal Psychological Science, and it is titled Investing in Karma. More about that in just a few moments, but since most all of Ben's work focuses on trying to determine what motivates us to be the way we are, let me note again, we are wide open for questions with our phone lines wide open right now, 888-WMRA-TALK. And then before I ask about this karma study, I got to know, are you reading my mind at this moment?
I'm always reading your mind, Tom, and you're always reading my mind. We have to do this. It's the only way we can interact in any way that makes any sort of sense.
Well, I'm going to have to ask you to explain this because it's my understanding that in your field, excuse me, there is now this understanding that most of us try to engage in some kind of mind reading with other human beings most of the time.
We absolutely have to. If you look at any piece of language, from a phone message to a text message to a tweet, we're communicating now in the fewest number of words all of the time. If you look at a message completely out of context, then it could mean infinite different things. And so to make any sense out of that kind of communication, I have to jump to some conclusions. I have to make some inferences about what's going on inside of your mind. I have to know about what knowledge you already have and what your motivations are and your intentions are. And only with all of that background and all of that inferential stuff can I start to make sense and pick one of the meanings that you might possibly have in mind. There's one paradigm that's been really powerful in this kind of research where you listen to a phone message, ostensibly between two other people, and the message says something like, "Hey, thanks for that restaurant recommendation. Things were great, just great." And that could mean a lot of different things. If you know that the meal was really good, then you know that that's a sincere thank you. It's a sincere piece of gratitude or a sincere reflection of gratitude. But if you know that the meal was terrible, then you can recognize that as sarcasm. But you have to know that background. And one of the ways in which egocentrism is revealed, this idea that sometimes I don't get outside of my mind effectively enough to understand yours, is that if I hear that message and I know that the meal was terrible, I'll say, yes, that was sarcastic. And then you ask me, what would somebody else, a third person who doesn't know how the meal actually went, how would they interpret that message? And if I'm being egocentric and not getting outside of my own perspective, and I know that it was sarcastic, I'm likely to say, yes, that third person will also hear the egocentrism, or will also hear the sarcasm there. They'll also know that really the meal stunk and that this was a flip way of saying it. And although we can be quite good at taking perspectives, the real challenge is, do we get far enough outside of our own minds? And so when I start making assumptions about what other people are going to believe, and I have certain background knowledge that they don't have, then I might start imputing too much onto what they're going to guess. And now all of a sudden we've got a divergence.
Dr. Ben Carvis, when you talk about being egocentric, are you in essence saying that although we have to make assumptions about what's going on in other people's minds when we're communicating with them, otherwise we couldn't operate, because not all of the information being transmitted is explicit in words. Is there something here, Ben, about that I might have an overly developed tendency to assume the other person thinks just the same way I do? That's my egocentrism going on?
Yeah, often the mental work that we have to do to coordinate with other people is really difficult. And so we're really good at finding shortcuts all of the time. And many judgments of other people's minds and judgments of lots of other things, they start with an easy shortcut. And when we have motivation and we have the incentive and we have energy and cognitive capacity to do so, then we adjust away from where we started. But the default for understanding what's going on in somebody's mind is our own mind. It's always right there. It's always at the tip of your tongue and always accessible to you. And so many times we start with that, and it's only under certain conditions that we're really good at moving far enough away. Often we don't have to move too far away. Often we have enough common ground that we can get along just fine with whether we're being egocentric or not. But the challenges and some of the social conflicts and the miscommunications come when we don't get far enough away.
Is part of that meaning that oftentimes when there's some sort of conflict going on, that I'm making too many assumptions about this other person seeing things the same way I do?
Right. Making too many assumptions, or not even recognizing that you're making assumptions at all. You just think that that's the true objective state of the world because that's all that you know. And one of the real foundational insights of social psychology is that it doesn't matter what the objective state of the world is out there. All that really matters in terms of our behavior and our decisions is the way that we perceive it. There are all these filters, all these expectations that bias information as it comes in. And when we start thinking that we see everything the way that it objectively is, and if you see something different, it's because you're wrong or you're biased or you're lazy or just a pain in the butt, then we get into real problems. And that's this idea of naive realism that really overlaps with the egocentrism.
You live with a social psychologist.
Yes, I do.
Your wife is in the same field. She does different areas of research, but I'm curious if some of the things that you're talking about might happen more often between males and females, because males and females might more often see things differently when we're assuming that we're seeing things the same. So I'm hoping that you can give me an example, a specific instance that you witnessed, maybe that you were engaged in, that demonstrates the kind of stuff that you're talking about. I don't know if I can ask you to talk about something that's happened with your wife, but you pick.
Well, Tom, you're being perfectly egocentric right now. So you've provided the great example. What's in front of you right now is that we're in the radio booth and we've got microphones and we're in the office here, and you're not seeing outside of your own perspective that I'm going to have to go home, listen to this with my wife and talk it over. But I will take that question. I won't pass on this challenge. I don't know whether these things are more likely to happen between men and women. Really don't know of any data on that topic. But these things are likely to happen between any two people who interact a lot, and sometimes even more so to people who are close, because we don't think so carefully about what the differences are. We get so used to being around somebody that we often just start to make those assumptions that the other person is thinking the way that I am. Classic example that maybe it's happened at my house, but happens in many houses, I'm sure, as well, is when somebody's out and another person is home, and we'll put it on the no good husband who's out having fun with his friends, and time is going by, and when you're out at the bar or you're out at a game or you're out having fun, concert, the time is just flying by, and so you're not thinking about what's going on back home. If the other person, the nice, calm, polite wife, is at home and is waiting for that call, time is dragging there. And why didn't you call? Why didn't you call? I was so nervous when you get home. And it's interesting how a fight can blow up out of something like that. And the fight generally stems down to something like, it's so inconsiderate that you didn't call because I was waiting and I was really nervous. And where the egocentrism comes in there is that the person who's at home and waiting is focused on this inconsideration of the other person, but doesn't realize that it wasn't even in their mind. They weren't sitting there staring at the clock waiting for things to come. And the amazing thing about this fight, just like many of these, is that then the tables will be turned and it'll be the husband at home and it'll be the wife that's out. And we could have the same exact fight all over again with the person that's at home saying, you were so inconsiderate. You didn't call. I was so scared. But there's no way for that person to know how scared you were because you're in that immediate experience. It's hard to think outside of that and to get outside of our own perspective on what's going on around us.
And of course, you have never been the no good husband who was out with friends and your phone battery died and you just lost track of time.
I am a PhD expert in social psychology, so there's no way that could ever happen in my house, Tom. Could never happen.
I've got a little bit of mind reading going on right now, but I want to let you know, in case you've just joined us, that social psychologist and motivation researcher Ben Converse is our guest. This is Virginia Insight. I'm Tom Graham. Our call-in number, should you care to use it, is 888-WMRA-TALK. Larry in Stanton, understand you just used that. Thanks for doing so. Your question or comment for Dr. Converse, please.
Yes, I wonder if maybe what you're talking about, Doctor, isn't a form of projection where you are projecting onto other people what you want them to think, how you want them to tune into what you're thinking, because obviously you're right because you thought of it.
Yeah,
that's a poor way of saying it. But I see day after day, I see especially people that are wrapped up in social media and wrapped up in their own little egocentric world, they are projecting onto other people what they think those other people should be saying, thinking, doing, feeling. I just wonder if that isn't also part of what you're talking about, or have I got the wrong idea?
No, you've got absolutely the right idea. I think what you're pointing to, there are two phenomena here that could potentially be driving a lot of these effects. And the truth is, in everyday life, it often doesn't matter which one's going on. To psychologists, we care a lot about this. The version that you're describing, and what you're calling projection, which is a fine term for it, is what we would call a sort of motivated projection, where I'm seeing something in your mind because that's what I want to see. That's exactly what you're talking about. And there are all kinds of demonstrations of that going on. There's also, alongside of that, a whole set of these kinds of biases and behavioral effects that can happen even without the motivation. So both are possible to happen. Part of it could also just be what we would call strictly cognitive, where I have no skin in the game. I don't particularly care what you think. My motivation is really to get it right, but I just get stuck inside my own head and don't put in that mental effort to get outside of it. But the version that you're talking about is all around us all the time as well. And just as you said, I think these things get really played up with the social media and with all of the choices that we have in our media every day. We can surround ourselves with people who think just like us. And so,
We don't learn anything when we surround ourselves with people who think just like we do, because I see this as another social problem, is people are afraid to think outside their own box, because if they do, then that means that they have to suspend belief in certain core values, and they're actually afraid that if they suspend those core values and go a mile away and look at something else, that they're going to lose something from their core values. So they're very timid about doing it, while at the same time they're saying, hey, you know, I'm a free thinker, I'm open to other ideas. And I mean, it really is quite a phenomenon. I'll hang up after this one last comment. I have seen also an extreme version of this go right to what I call, this is a copyrighted term, it's called attention getting disorder. And it comes from wanting to make sure that you know, dressing in a certain way and displaying yourself in a certain way and talking in a certain way so that other people who think just like you do gravitate toward you, and then that becomes a community.
Larry, thanks so much for your observations. Excuse me, I'm sorry, we are just about to hit the break, but I'm going to ask Ben to respond when we get back in just a bit more than 1 minute. And the nice lady who was calling from Charlottesville, we just lost your call, so if you want to call right back, we'll get to you after the break too, here on Virginia Insight. Dr. Ben Converse is our guest. His newest study, published in the journal Psychological Science, is titled Investing in Karma When Wanting Promotes Helping. This is Virginia Insight. I'm Tom Graham. Ben, do I understand correctly that that one of the things that this new research is about, in essence, is that people try to get the universe to believe that they're good people when they want something?
It's at least that people behave as if that's what's going on. And that's one of the really interesting puzzles for us. You know, I teach master's in public policy students, and I have a bunch of second-year students right now, and they're all out on the job market.
And so these are people in their mid-20s?
Some of them are, and some of them are also postgraduates who have been out working for a while, a little bit closer to their 30s. But they're all ready to go out and get a job. And of course, that looms so large in their minds. This is the biggest thing going on right now. And at a certain point, their work is done. They can only do so much. You send out all of the resumes and you shake all of the hands and you do all of the research. But at a certain point, all of your materials are out and you're just sitting around waiting. And then they're in a situation where they feel like they don't have control over what's going on. And at that point, it seems like it's in the universe's hands, whatever that means to you. For some people, that's God. For some people, it's fate. For others, it's luck. But when things are out under that universe control, we don't like it. And we work really hard to get a better sense of control over what's going on. Our studies find that people that are in those kinds of situations, if we get our students thinking, for example, about those jobs that they're waiting for, and then as they go on to another room, they happen to pass somebody that's, you know, got the donation bucket out, they're more likely to drop a few coins in that donation bucket after they've been thinking about this outcome that they really want, compared to some other control group who's been thinking about themselves but not outcomes that they can't control. They haven't been thinking about the universe in that way. One of the exciting things about this for us is that we found this in a number of studies, but what we didn't find was that people who told us they were more superstitious were more likely to do this. It was even people who don't report having superstitious beliefs. It was even people who don't necessarily report being religious. And so that's a real puzzle then. What's driving this behavior? Why is this feeling of being out of control and wanting something really badly getting people to behave well in this way? And we think that what might be going on is that over time, we're really good at protecting certain cherished beliefs. The last caller was just talking about how we protect cherished beliefs. And one of those cherished beliefs that we want to protect, that we're really motivated to protect, is the sense that that we have control over our actions, and that if we work really hard, things will come back to us. And the other one is that the world is a just place and good things happen to good people. And there are all kinds of automatic things that we do to keep that belief intact without even noticing that we're doing it. So, for example, if you see on the news some terrible thing happen to a public figure and it just doesn't make sense, it's random and it's a terrible thing, often what we'll just do automatically without even realizing it is we'll grasp for some explanation to keep that just world belief intact. And so we'll say, there is that immoral thing that this star did in the past, and then we'll link those events. And what my collaborators and I, Jane Risen and Travis Carter, started to think is that over time, if we keep protecting these beliefs and keep protecting these beliefs, then we end up with this really strong association between good people and good outcomes. So then when we get back to our students who are out on the job market, when they're in this situation where they don't have personal control, there's nothing else that they can do to help their chances of getting a job, but they really want this good outcome, that association may kick in and they may have to indulge this feeling of, well, at least if I can do something good, then I might be able to improve my odds, even if they wouldn't necessarily endorse that that's what they were doing, even if they didn't consciously think
that's
what was going on.
Yeah, that's one of the things that's fascinating about so many of your studies is you find that people are engaging in thoughts and behaviors that they don't know that they are doing or that they don't know that they have. And it is part of what you're saying, Dr. Converse, that we all want to believe that people get treated fairly in general in the world, that good people have good things happen to them and bad people have bad things happen to them?
That seems to be quite clear, actually, from a lot of research, not the kind of research that we're doing, but we think that that's the root of the kind of phenomenon that we've demonstrated recently, that there are all these strategies, many of these have been documented in studies, of things like derogating the victim. And when somebody's victimized and we can somehow put that off and just cast the victim in a poor light.
So even, if somebody has something really bad happen to them, they get mugged or attacked or something, we are much more likely to say, even if not necessarily, well, they were a bad person who deserved it, but they were dumb enough to be in the wrong place at the wrong time.
Precisely. What you start, you get an image of your mind of a reckless person who is out behaving badly and running around late at night.
Because that helps us maintain our own belief that good things are going to happen to me because I'm a good person, or at least bad things won't happen to me just randomly.
That's right. Exactly.
And so in this karma study, one of the things that you were finding then is that if there's somebody listening, for example, that's really felt they've done all they could to get a new job that they really want, and everything else now, that there are no other buttons that they can push, nobody else they can call, no new resumes to send out, that now when they pass the Salvation Army bucket, they're going to be more charitable because they figure being more charitable makes the universe view them as that much better a person, so good things are more likely to happen to them?
Yeah, I think that's what may be going on for some people, where they think that all the way through. And I think that other people, just because in the past they'd gone through so many instances of what we were just talking about derogating the victim or protecting this belief in any way, that you now just have this association in your mind of good people and good outcomes. And so even if you wouldn't say, yes, I really believe that by putting a few dollars in that Salvation Army bucket that the gods are going to smile down on me, there's just an association there. I'm waiting for this outcome. I want it. I want it. I want it. And so when you pass that bucket, the association kicks in, and it's just kind of an autopilot response to this.
So to you who are listening, how often do you think you attempt to engage in what we were talking about earlier as mind reading? Maybe I can put this question another way. Have you ever had a sense that someone you know, a friend, a coworker, a family member, was assuming things about you that weren't really true, and that those assumptions got in the way of a better relationship? If you'd be willing to tell us about it, 888-WMRA. Talk is how to reach us by phone. That's 888-967-2825. Of course, on Facebook, you can find us listed as WMRA's Virginia Insight. And we have this Dr. Ben Converse on Facebook from Sarah, who says, I have a friend who swears she does not believe in God, but she is frequently using phrases like, God help me, that give me pause. Is she revealing some secret belief that she just won't admit to?
That's a tough one to say. It's hard to know whether the belief is really there. She's just using an idiom that she hears all around her. Although we find something in some ways similar to that in some of our karma studies. If we just get people thinking about outcomes that they want, so we have some people, we just say, you know, we prompt this question, is there something in your life like that where you're waiting for this outcome and you don't have control over it? And students will often write about the job market. We've done this with adults who will write about things like, you know, I just had some medical tests and I'm waiting to see how this is going to play out. And then we have people do a word puzzle. And the word puzzle is a fill in the blank puzzle. And it says some of the words in there are words like K-A blank, blank, blank. And if you've been listening to us for the last few minutes, then it's very likely that it's going to pop into your mind that I would fill that word out with karma. If you hadn't been listening to all of this and this wasn't at the top of your mind, then you might think that I'll fill that out with kayak, right? Or we have a word like L blank CK, and it could be luck or it could be lack or lock. And so we can get baseline measures of how likely people are to fill in those words with those questions with various words. And what we find in our studies is just by prompting people to think about these outcomes that are out of their control, it increases the likelihood of them filling in those blanks with a word like karma or a word like luck or a word like fate. So there's some association that's there, even if that explicit belief isn't there. And perhaps when somebody says something about God help me, even though they profess that they don't believe in God, that association might still be there, and that might be what's reflected in that behavior.
So if our friend Sarah here wrote on a piece of paper G blank blank and handed it to her friend, and her friend wrote OD or AP, God or gap, Susan or Sarah really couldn't tell anything about her friend that if she filled it out by the word God, that she really thought more about God than she admitted to.
Well, so this is what Sarah should try at home. Sarah's got to catch her friend in a normal situation, eating lunch or whatever, when she's pretty unlikely to be thinking about that, and have her do this and see how she fills it out. And maybe do this 100 times or so she gets a good baseline. And see what's the percentage of times that she fills it out with gap versus God. Sometimes God is just going to pop to mind. It doesn't necessarily mean anything about her beliefs. But say it's 30% of the time she comes up with God. Well, then Sarah should have her friend do the same puzzle in some other circumstances where people are likely to think of God if they really believe in God. In those times when they're really suffering and they need some help, or in those times when they're really grateful and they want to give that thanks somewhere. And have her friend do this puzzle another 100 times. And if that percentage jumps up to, say, 60%, then Sarah might be relatively confident in saying, yes, maybe my friend does believe in God, and certain situations seem to prompt it. Now, we wouldn't know if it was an explicit belief or if it was just the association that her friend has, that there's cultural knowledge that on Sunday people are going to praise God, and everybody or many people have that association, whether they actually believe or not. And so that's the trick that would remain left unexplained, even with our guerrilla experiment here.
Social psychologist Ben Convers is our guest. 888-967-2825 is our phone number. Lewis in Charlottesville, thanks for calling in here on Virginia Insight. Your question or comment, please.
I was listening a little while, and actually I'm driving around going back home, and I heard all this doing good, and you made an example of the Salvation Army, and they're a faith-based group. And I retired from a prison. I got to see man very close. And I found that the studies are very much a biblical thing. We want to please the Lord Jesus Christ, and therefore we want to do the right thing. But many other people don't do that. There's other people that if they don't get what they want, they turn into other behavioral traits like alcohol, drinking a little too much, maybe into drugs, abusive behaviors, and the list is endless. So I wanted to ask, what does he feel overall, the study that he's talking in? And I hear a lot of we think. So it doesn't sound like we know. And who knows the mind of man anyway, except the Lord Jesus Christ. I'll hang up. I'll listen to you.
Thank you very much for your call, Lewis. It sounds to me, Dr. Ben Convers, that part of what Lewis was saying is, how much do we know that people are trying to behave in a good way because whether they believe in God or a God or not, they believe that if they are good, good will happen to them?
Right. So, and I think it's certainly the case that many of our participants probably do have that kind of reasoning going on, that's precisely the reason they're being good people. What the real tool of the trade for psychologists is that we run experiments. And so we start off with a large group of people to see how much good do people do. In our studies, it's not the case that the only people who are charitable or who are reaching out to help others are people who are in these situations where they want something. And so we can get what we would call a baseline measure to see how generous are people in this particular situation. And in some of our studies where we set out a donation booth, people will, in the control condition where they've just done some regular mundane tasks, they might donate 50 cents on average. Where psychology really comes in and can teach us something about what's driving behavior is that we'll then take another group of people who are randomly assigned to be in this new condition. So there shouldn't be anything that's inherently different about that group unless it happens by rare chance. And so we'll put them in certain situations and find out what kinds of conditions are likely to change their behavior. In our studies, we find that those donations jump up to somewhere around $1 in this particular study after people have written about the kinds of outcomes that they're waiting to happen. And so we can say, yes, there's this increase that's caused by this set of conditions where you want something that's important and it's out of your personal control. And so we know that much about what's driving behavior. As far as people's underlying belief systems, whether it's a specific God according to some religion or some other belief system that people have that's really driving that, right now that's still a mystery to us, and we're working on figuring out what those underlying thoughts are. But presumably it's a lot of those things, and it depends on which one's going on for different people.
We're looking at the kind of thinking and behavior that human beings often engage in when we are on autopilot in our daily lives. Our guest researches and teaches social psychology and leadership at the University of Virginia's Batten School of Leadership, Dr. Benjamin Converse. This is Virginia Insight. I'm Tom Graham, 888-WMRA-TALK, how to reach us by phone. Bill in Timberville, thanks for calling in. Your question or comment for Dr. Converse, please.
Oh, hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I'd like to, you know, point out that there's a long and varied tradition in religions of what you might call karma. In Islam, they have an expression, all beggars and strangers come from Allah, come from God. In Christianity, Jesus says, as you have done to the least among us is like you have done it for me. It's not kind of magical thinking. It's kind of nuts and bolts metaphysics that as you act in the world will reflect this back to you. I think there's a real religious component that's not kind of knock on wood superstition here. I'd be interested to hear your guest comment on that.
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, what we know from our studies is that some of the people who show these kinds of effects and exhibit these behaviors are in fact religious. We often ask them at the end of a study or sometimes separate from the study and then compare it later. And so many of our participants are religious, but we run these studies. Many of these studies I ran at the University of Chicago, and so we got a very broad swath of the population. And many of the participants were not religious at all, or not formally religious, at least as far as they told us. And we still see these effects even with those participants. And
so you have people responding as if they want to create good karma for themselves, who don't have any conscious belief that there is such a thing as karma.
As far as they tell us, yeah, that's exactly right.
Bill, thank you so very much for your call. To anyone who is thinking about calling in, we're willing to entertain just about any question that relates to social psychology. But let me also ask, how much do you think you understand why you behave the way you do? Have you ever caught yourself acting on a kind of autopilot and suddenly realized that you may have been operating on some sort of beliefs that are not normally part of your conscious thinking? Willing to tell us about it? 888-WMRA-TALK is how to reach us by phone. On Facebook, we are listed as Virginia Insight, and we will be back in just a bit more than 1 minute. To you on the other side of your radio, if you are in your car now or have been recently, what kinds of things did you notice during your drive? Were there billboards that caught your eye or that you completely ignored? Were you driving a route that you've done many times before and thus able to do it without paying much conscious attention? How does that kind of drive differ from what goes on for you when you are traveling a new route for the very first time? We are looking at what might happen when we pause to take a new look at automatic patterns in our lives. If you've got a story that you're willing to share or a question to ask, 888-WMRA-TALK is how to reach us by phone. And Ben Converse, one of the reasons I mention this is that I understand that you talk in some of your research about depending what our mood or state is when we're driving, it can very much affect what we're noticing.
Yeah, absolutely. So when we have conversations about motivation, often what we think about are all those things that we're really controlling ourselves, like whether we can stop ourselves from procrastinating or if we're dealing with a self-control conflict. But there's also all this stuff that's going on beneath the surface, a lot of stuff that we leave over to autopilot, and it's often quite useful for us. So if you're driving down the highway right now, you might be just cruising along. Hopefully you're listening very intently to us and focused in, but also driving safely. But you might notice that when those hunger pangs start to set in, all of a sudden your attention goes somewhere else. You start noticing the golden arches way off on the horizon. You start to see the signs that say McDonald's is coming up or Burger King or whatever it might be. And that's a case of often really adaptive functional autopilot, where there's so much going on in the world, we can't pay attention to all of it. And our immediate needs and goals seem to be able to really direct our attention. And so this is useful for helping you to find food when you need it. It turns out that it also has some really interesting effects on our relationships and how we get along with other people and help other people. There's been some fascinating research done by other labs that shows, for example, if I just ask you to list, say, 10 of your friends, that list will change quite a bit depending on what's going on and what your goals are right at that moment. If it's Tuesday morning and you're really in work mode, then although your best friend might still be at the top of the list across situations, your friends at work who are really helpful to you and help you get that work done, they're going to rise a little bit on that list compared to if I ask you on Friday afternoon when you're starting to think about your other goals for socializing and relaxation. All of a sudden, that list is going to look quite different, and your party friends or your relaxing friends are going to rise to the top of that list. Now, this is useful for helping us to find those people who are helpful to us in our daily lives, who will support us in our different goals. One of the questions that we had in our research was, how does this affect our emotional responses to getting help? How grateful do we feel during and after instances of receiving help from other people? So for me, I think just about the greatest thing that you can do for another person, for a good friend, is to show up on moving day. That's when you know who your real friends are. Who shows up when you've got a couch to go up 3 flights of stairs? And what we were interested in was, how do those grateful feelings change over the course of that interaction? And we did studies that essentially would stop people in the middle of a task like that. So we would ask people while they're moving, while they're receiving help, how grateful do you feel to your friend right now for doing this? And we would ask other people after it was all over. One of the interesting things is that when we ask the helpers to guess how this is going to play out, they think what most of us think, which is that the gratitude is going to be much higher later on when you're all set up and all the furniture is in the right place and this task is accomplished. What we found time and time again, not from people who were actually moving, but from people who were in studies doing various other tasks, was that they actually felt more grateful while this is going on.
While they're actually getting the help.
While they're actually getting the help, because that's when you're high and dry without the help. That's when the person is really instrumental. You really depend on them. You're all keyed up. You're amped up to get this thing done. It's got to happen. You're really motivated.
So after you've drunk the water, after you are no longer parched, your thirst has been quenched, you're really not feeling as grateful as we might expect you would.
Yeah.
It was while you were drinking the water that you were feeling grateful.
Exactly. And some of the basic experiments have been done exactly with water and with that thirst quenching goal completion. And what you find sometimes is that it even goes, in some of the studies, it goes even lower. So you might be fast to see water in an array when you're really thirsty, and you might be at a moderate speed when you're not thirsty. But immediately after you've had the water, you're actually slower in some cases, so it's even inhibited. And that seems like a good idea to the motivational system, because now that you have the water, you've got to turn towards something else. You've got a new goal. Now, with relationships, that can be a little bit tricky, because you had all these great intentions of writing that thank you card and sending that thank you gift and all of these things. But as soon as all the furniture's in the house, now you got to call the cable guy and you got to get the internet set up and you're on to something else. Now, it all sounds very cynical and Machiavellian, like we only use people the way we need them. The first thing to notice is that it doesn't go in terms of gratitude. It doesn't go all the way back to zero. If we're talking about a 7-point scale here, maybe it's a 7 while you're actually getting that help, and then it drops down to a 6 or a 5 after that help. So there's still gratitude, and it lingers around, and gratitude is really beneficial for relationships and for really bringing people together and cementing them. But what we find is this little boost while things are actually going on.
Social psychologist Dr. Ben Converse is our guest. I apologize for interrupting, but all of a sudden we have lots of people waiting to talk to you, so let's get to some of them. Next to Harrisonburg, Jay, thank you for joining us on Virginia Insight. Your question or comment, please.
Good afternoon. A comment about automatic pilot. Many years ago, I lived in Peru, a very Catholic country, and I'm not Catholic myself, and I would take the bus, and every time the bus passed either a church or a cemetery, they'd make the mark of the cross, of course, but everybody on the bus. And in time, within a few months, so was I.
Yeah, those rituals can be really powerful. And, you know, there's a big question there about whether that affects somebody's beliefs. But often, a lot of our behavior is just driven by social norms. What's everybody around us doing? And it can get into a routine where we end up doing these things. And then maybe even after you came home from Peru, you still found yourself doing that, at least for a time. And so one of the questions that I would be interested in is how much is this just an automatic behavior where you're just kind of going through the motions, and how much of it is something that actually changes in your beliefs? It's entirely possible that the beliefs may end up following that. Another very fascinating classic foundational finding from social psychology is that often our attitudes follow our beliefs rather than the other way around. So sometimes we learn about what's really important to us by observing what we're doing.
Jay, so I guess our question is, did you notice after a period of time of this experience that your attitude towards Catholicism, your sense of affection for it, changed any?
Well, my father had been raised a Catholic, and my father did his best not to raise us as Catholics. And so it did make me, not in terms of beliefs, but an affinity for Catholicism. And I guess when I'm really stressed out, I still might cross myself because it wouldn't hurt.
Jay, thank you so much for sharing that with us. We're going next to Bridgewater. Sarah, you're on Virginia Insight with Dr. Ben Converse. Your question or comment, please.
Idea of illusion of control really resonates with me. I'm a biologist. I don't believe the world is a fair place. I don't think of myself as religious or superstitious. But I think the human brain is inclined towards superstition, possibly this illusion of control thing. And I find myself laughing at myself when I play tennis, and I hit a ball and I win the point. I have a preference for using that same ball again, and that just strikes me as my own illusion of control.
Well, you sound like a lot of other athletes in the world and people who don't have as much control over what's going on as they would like to. Many of us who wouldn't necessarily say, yes, I believe that it's going to help me to use this ball or to wear these dirty socks for 15 games in a row, still can't help it, right? It gets into our routine of how we do this. And maybe there's just that ping of belief where it's, you know, maybe this will help. And it certainly doesn't cost anything to try it out, so might as well go through with it. Who knows how much of it is actually that, too.
Sarah, thank you so very much for sharing that vivid imagery that I think many of us can identify with.
Oh, thank you.
In his pursuit of understanding why human beings act the way they do, when they themselves don't understand what they're doing, Dr. Ben Converse has toted heaps of cash along the streets of Chicago, had peanuts thrown at him at Major League Baseball games, and hosted Do You Want to Be a Millionaire-type contests in psychological laboratories, although top prizes in those labs, we understand, was usually less than $20. Dr. Converse is spending time with us today to share his insights on some of the things he teaches at the University of Virginia, including motivation and leadership. We've got just a couple more minutes to take calls, so if you want to talk to Ben, please give us a call right now at 888-967-2825. Dr. Converse, getting back to our first caller, Larry, who ended his call just before we hit a break with something I've been meaning to get back to. If I recall correctly, I think Larry was saying that it's his supposition that many people engage in what I think he called attention-getting behavior, trying to get others to see them. In other words, if I was engaging in this behavior, I would be making efforts consciously and unconsciously to get you to see me as positively as possible. Do you think Larry's onto something there?
Yeah, I think, we have such a drive for, such a need, such a hunger for social affiliation. And the way that people seek that may vary, and they have different strategies for doing this. Maybe this attention-getting behavior is one of those strategies. Hey, I'm out here waving your arms back and forth to make sure people know that you're there. We need to be accepted by at least some group. And so, I'm going out on a limb here, and I don't know exactly the kinds of behaviors he's thinking about, but it sounds to me like it's one of those strategies to break into the group, some group, any group, just to make sure that we're not out there facing all of this alone.
The end result of much of your research, Ben Converse, has to do with what motivates people to behave the way they do. And I would guess, especially since you also teach about leadership at the Latin School, at the Batten School, is that this understanding helps in business, helps in politics, helps in organizations, understanding how to get maybe workers to behave more in a way that the leaders of those organizations would like. You're nodding your head.
Yes, absolutely.
So can you maybe share a little bit about what you've learned about motivation, about maybe how bosses can get workers to do more of what they want them to do?
I'd love to. And another good example of egocentrism for you is nodding your head on the radio. one of the big things that we try to teach our students, and I'm at a school of leadership and public policy, which is really a unique take for a public policy school, because our underlying belief is that we can train students, potential policymakers or future policymakers, to go out and they can have all of these analysis tools and all of the specific knowledge. But ultimately, you've got to get things done with people, and you've got to get people moving toward a common goal. And ideally, you want them moving toward a common goal willingly and enthusiastically and with commitment. That's true in policy. It's true in business. As you said, it's true in relationships. And we spend a lot of time talking about the assumptions we make about other people's motivation compared to the realities of motivation. We were just talking about a study yesterday that...
Well, I don't want to engage in too much egocentrism here, but I need to tell you that we've got less than 2 minutes left.
All right.
So if you want to factor that into whatever story you're going to tell, I hope you can get to something we can all use about motivation, motivating ourselves or motivating others.
Yeah, I think the strongest thing you can do is to take perspectives. And often the best way to take a perspective is to ask the other person. We often skip that step because although we don't have perfect insight, we have some insight into what drives us and into what's meaningful to us. And if you're trying to motivate someone to do anything, my best advice is don't jump right away to trying to pay them or trying to put some reward from the outside. Find out what's going on inside of their mind, whether it's through your perspective-taking skills or through your communication skills, where you find out what's going on inside their mind by asking them, and then
because
tap into that.
What the research is showing, including the research that you've done, is that people are more likely to stay motivated if it comes from an internal source, and if they're doing it just for the money or just because they'll get cookies if they eat their broccoli, that the eating of the broccoli becomes more and more of a chore instead of doing it because you develop a taste for doing it.
If you're building an organization of any kind, you want that behavior to still be there even when the money is gone, even when the cookies are gone. You want people still driving at that organization's goals. And so the only way to do that, exactly as you said, is to find out what really motivates them personally. And that's a challenge for perspective taking and getting outside of your own mind. And it's also a challenge for understanding how low-level motivation works, the stuff that's below the surface, as well as
Richard
the stuff.
Richard and Shenandoah, we're just about out of time, but if you can make your question quick, we'd love to see if we can address it.
Yeah, real quick question on addiction. Unfortunately, I have experience with that in our family, and someone who's recovering.
Richard, I'm sorry, we're just about out of time. Real quick, five-second question.
I can't seem to get this person to understand that if she doesn't stop her addictive behavior, things won't change for her.
Okay, Richard, And in 30 seconds, anything that relates to what you're doing that connects to addiction problems?
Well, having people just jump to making people take perspectives is not necessarily the best way to do it because we don't always get it right. So the best thing I can say, at least as a first step, is to communicate how this is affecting people, have people do it face to face, and really reveal what's going on inside of their heads rather than trying to make somebody make those inferences.
But that's sometimes why the interventions can be so powerful?
I think it may be. It's not something that we've done a lot of work on, but yeah, communicating is often the best way to circumvent these perspective-taking problems.
Richard, thanks so much for your call, and I'm sorry for the short amount of time, but we do need to note that our guest has been Dr. Ben Converse, lead author of the study Investing in Karma When Wanting Promotes Helping that appeared in the August issue of Psychological Science. By the way, Dr. Converse is also an assistant professor of psychology and public policy at the University of Virginia's Batten School of Leadership. Ben, thanks so much for your time.
Thank you, Tom.
You can find audio postings of Virginia Insight by going online to WMRA.org, then clicking on Programs, and then clicking on Virginia Insight. And if you go to that page, you will find links to more information about the work that Dr. Converse is doing. Insight's executive producer is Matt Bingay. Our associate producers, Terry Ward and Bob Levicky. Some of our break music supplied by Robert Chaspe and Inner Rhythm. Thanks so much for tuning in for this edition. I'm Tom Graham. Hope we can get together again soon for more insight.